All right, well, thank you. Thank you all for coming. I've been working on climate change at CBO for about 6 or 7 years. And out of all the cap and trade design issues that I've worked on, nothing has received as much attention as the allowance allocation question. And so I'm happy to be here today chairing a panel of people that are leading researchers on the implications of that allocation decision. So I think it's going to be a very interesting morning. I thought I'd just start by giving a little bit of an overview on cap and trade basics with an eye to understanding what's going on with the allocation process. So first of all, as you all probably know, there's a variety of cap and trade programs under consideration by the Congress, and they vary in a lot of different ways, but each of them has basically four basic ingredients. First, policymakers would set an overall cap on the level of carbon dioxide emissions, and then the government would require firms to hold rights, which we refer to as permits or allowances, to those emissions. In general, the designs under consideration would either place that allowance requirement upstream on fossil fuel suppliers or further downstream on large electricity generators or some hybrid in between that. Once the allowances requirement has been set, the government would have to determine how to allocate the allowances, which is the focus of the panel today. There's two key decisions. The key decision is whether or not these allowances would be sold in an auction, in which case the government would get the revenue and then would need to determine what to do with it, or whether or not they would be given away for free. There's historic precedent for both. Under the cap and trade program for sulfur dioxide emissions under the acid rain program, the vast majority of them, nearly all the allowances, were given away for free. And but yet we sold rights to the electromagnetic spectrum, so there's some precedent for each of those. Once the allowances are distributed, firms would then be free to buy and sell them amongst themselves, and in that way we would be relying on market forces to identify the least cost emission reductions. So the potential effects, as Peter has already alluded to, of cap and trade program are twofold. The main reason why we would be trying to do this is that we could reduce environmental and economic damages in the future. And although there's uncertainty about that, there's at least some potential that those damages could be substantial. On the other hand, any attempt to cap carbon dioxide emissions would impose costs on the economy in the near term. That's because the cap would basically limit the use of fossil fuels, and that supply restriction would in turn raise prices for fossil fuel and for energy intensive goods and services. Those price increases would filter throughout the whole economy and create a cost in a variety of different ways. First of all, consumers would incur costs to try and reduce their use of energy intensive goods and services. And because of the reduction in the demand for those goods, shareholders in those industries and workers as well could incur losses. Those losses are likely to be greatest in a couple of sectors, particularly the coal sector. While the decrease in equity values could be significant in the coal sector, the loss to shareholders would actually be widely distributed among households to the extent that shareholders have diversified portfolios. In contrast, losses to workers are likely to be concentrated on a fairly small number of households, so potentially large losses to a small number of households versus widely distributed losses to shareholders. Another cost that economists have worried about is that the price increases that would result from a cap and trade program could actually aggravate distortions that are caused by existing taxes on capital and labor. And although that sounds like a minor issue, in fact, some of the research shows that that cost could actually be quite large, perhaps a significant share of the overall cost to the economy. So in addition to imposing these actual costs on the economy, a cap and trade program would transfer a significant amount of income. And that income would be transferred from the people that pay for the allowances to the people that receive the value of the allowances. So how does that work? Well, by capping carbon dioxide emissions, we're actually creating a new commodity. And that commodity is the right to emit carbon dioxide. And those rights, these allowances, would have a substantial amount of value. Someone will pay for those allowances, and someone will receive the income from those allowances. So the full value of the allowances is going to be transferred among households in the economy. And the reason why this is such a particularly big deal for carbon dioxide emissions is shown by this next figure here. This illustrates the potential range of the value of the allowances for carbon dioxide emissions under the proposed legislation on the Hill recently, and it could range from $50 to $300 billion based on some of the analysis that we did of some of the proposals a couple months ago. In contrast, the value of the SO2 allowances in 2005 was one or two orders of magnitude smaller. So there's a lot of income is going to be transferred based on decisions that policymakers make about how to allocate the allowances. So it's important, it has big implications. So who would ultimately end up bearing the cost for these allowances? Getting an allowance, holding an allowance, will become a cost of doing business, and firms will have to acquire them. However, the firm may not actually bear the cost of holding the allowance. It's likely that those costs will be primarily passed on to households, and market forces will determine the extent to which that happens. Most research shows that the vast majority of the allowance costs would be passed on to households in the form of higher prices for energy-intensive goods and services. In contrast, policymakers, not the market, but policymakers, will determine who gets the value of those allowances. As I said, the two main choices are to either sell them, in which case the government gets that value and decides how to distribute it, what to do with it, or to give them away for free, in which case the firms that receive those capture the value. In addition to having a profound effect on the overall distribution of the gains and losses associated with the policy, decisions about how to allocate the allowances could actually have a fairly large effect on the overall cost of a cap and trade program on the economy. That's because policymakers could, if they chose to, sell the allowances and use the allowance value to offset to reduce existing taxes that discourage economic activity. And so in that way, it gives them an opportunity to potentially lower the overall cost to the economy. So as my brief overview has hopefully convinced you, this is both an important topic and also a very complicated one. And for that reason, we are very fortunate to have the panel here that we have today, because no one model or analysis can capture all the dimensions of this problem, the implications of the decision about how policymakers would allocate the allowances. But each of the researchers on the panel here today has focused on a different piece of that puzzle. And so it's be very interesting to hear them all speak. Larry Goulder is going to start, and he's going to focus on how the allocation decision affects net losses to particular industries and how it can affect the overall cost of the economy. And next, Dallas Bertraw is going to focus on the electricity sector and also talk a little bit about the difference between net losses to the industry as a whole versus firm-level losses. And then Gib Metcalf is going to focus on household-level effects. And finally, Dick Gettle is going to be talking about both household-level effects and trade-offs with overall costs of the economy and using a slightly different kind of modeling approach than the other panelists. So, again, I'm very pleased to have these panel members here today, and I turn it over to Larry. Let's see. Oh, just, okay.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Down here?
You're right here. And there we go.
Okay. Can you hear me? Well, thank you very much, Terry, and thank you, Peter, also. I really appreciate having been invited to be here at this conference. I do think the issues are important, and I'm looking forward to the discussion. As Terry indicated, what I'm going to do is to concentrate on two issues related to allowance allocation. The general issue is how does allowance, what is the impact of cap and trade on profits of various U.S. industries, and more specifically, how does the impact on profits depend on how the allowances are allocated, whether it's free, via an auction, or actually some combination of the two. It doesn't have to be either or. And there's been a lot of theoretical work in the last 6-7 years on this issue that's provided some insights. There's also been work or results from computer models or numerical simulations to illustrate the impacts. And in addition, I think we've learned something from recent experience. In particular, the European Union's emissions trading system, I think, has given some indications of how important allowance allocation can be and how, under some circumstances, free allocation can create windfalls. So I'd like to try to elucidate these issues in what follows. As a starting point, let's take a look at what happens in under 100% auctioning. And this is not to commit to any particular model runs, but at least to try to give a gist of the range of possibilities. Here's the results from a computer model of my own. It's a general equilibrium model where cap and trade is assumed to be introduced in the year 2000. It's a cap that is such as to cause allowance prices to be about $6.75 per ton of CO2 originally, and then rising up to $13.50 per ton. And on average, it achieves about a 17% reduction in emissions over the first 50 or 60 years. And what you see in this case is that the impacts under 100% auctioning, which functions a lot like a tax, are especially concentrated in those industries that are supplying fossil fuels, especially coal. What we have here are the impacts on the percentage change in equity values, which you can think of as sort of the average reduction in profit discounted over time. So it's a whopping effect here, in this case about a 50% reduction in average profitability of coal mining. Oil and gas also has a significant effect. And then other industries, particularly those industries that intensively use fossil fuels, such as petroleum refining and electric utilities, are also hit relatively hard. So what question arises here is, you know, politically, this poses a real issue if you're going to introduce costs this great on industries that have a very important stake in the outcome and have a lot of political muscle. In addition, there's serious issues of fairness here. Is there a way that you could allocate the allowances so as to avoid these profit impacts? And the answer is yes. And actually, free allocation, indeed, you don't have to allocate all the allowances free. Just a little bit of free allocation is enough to avoid serious profit impacts. And I should say that I'm indebted to Peter Orszag for some of these findings, because it was several years ago, I hate to think how many, where he kind of put the idea to me saying, you know, if we give out these allowances free, we might get really big rents. And I thought about it for a while, and I thought, yeah, in fact, this might be those rents might be enough to compensate for what otherwise would have been profit losses. So now it's come back to haunt you, Peter. So let's take a look then, first analytically, and then with some numerical results as to how allocation can make a difference. And this is the one supply and demand diagram I'm going to offer today, just one. And I'll just go through it very briefly. The example here, just to keep it simple, is with a completely upstream system where the allowances must be submitted and held by the fossil fuel suppliers like the coal industry or the oil and gas industry. But a similar diagram would apply if you did it a little bit more downstream, for example, if allowances were held by electricity generators or petroleum refiners. And The first thing to note is that when you introduce allowances, you have a restriction on the amount of emissions because there's only so many allowances given out, presumably less than, would imply less emissions than under business as usual. But that also correlates with a reduction in output for the firms that have to submit allowances, because the constraint on emissions implies a reduction in output. Indeed, for the fossil fuel suppliers, there's a proportional relation between the allowances or CO2 and the amount of output. So output has to be reduced in this example from Q0 to Q1 as a result of the allowance restriction. And the restriction in supply means that prices get bid up as you move up the demand curve from P0 to P1. If you auction the allowances, it's really like a tax. That increase in price represents, in effect, the tax associated with auctioning the allowances. And producers lose in this case. They lose an amount of producer surplus given by the trapezoidal-shaped region here on the diagram. And that big rectangle R represents the value of the allowances, which is paid as under the auction to the government. So producers lose under 100% auctioning. They lose that trapezoidal area. In contrast, if you give the allowances out free, again, there's a gross loss of producer surplus, same trapezoidal area. Since there's a restriction in supply, the price goes up by the same amount as under 100% auction. So that's the same under 100% auction versus 100% free allocation. But there's one big difference, and that is that since the allowances are given out free, the firms no longer have to pay this amount R, that big rectangle, to the government. They collect that as a rent. In effect, the government has created something like a cartel. By restricting allowances, they've caused a restriction in output that's caused prices to go up. Competitive firms ordinarily wouldn't be able to raise prices like that, but now they will because the output's been restricted because of the allowance restriction. And they collect in something like cartel rents. And in this case, that area R is drawn here. Those rents are greater than the gross profit loss. So firms actually make out ahead under 100% free allocation in this case. And that's the gist of the idea that says free allocation can not only prevent a profit loss, indeed can cause a profit increase. Now, this is all kind of academic scribbling. And, you know, there's been some numerical computer work that's done that's indicated the same thing. There's been some theoretical work. But perhaps one thing that helped clinch it, perhaps was more important than all the academic work, was the recent experience in the European Union where they gave out 95% or more of the allowances free, and there's significant evidence that there are serious windfalls that occurred as a result. So don't take my word for it. Look at the European Union experience. So that's the basic idea. Now, one thing that's important to realize is that you don't necessarily have to consider these extreme cases of 100% free allocation versus 100% auctioning. One could do something in between. And indeed, in this case, it suggests that if you give out some share, maybe only 25 or 20% of the allowances free, that would be enough to generate enough rents to compensate for the gross loss of profit. And so I want to suggest that to you from a numerical simulation. This is the same model that I mentioned just a moment ago, but now I've added a column. And in that far right column, we give out just a small share of the allowances free, around 10%, to the oil and gas and coal industries. And that's enough, as you see, to prevent a loss of profit or a loss of equity value. Now those numbers that were negative turn out to be zero. So the numerical model suggests that just a small amount of free allocation is enough to create enough rent to compensate for the loss of profit. And then you could do something else. You could freely allocate some allowances downstream as well to prevent losses of profit, say, to petroleum refining and electric utilities. A close-up picture is on this next graph, where this is basically just providing additional information for the simulations I mentioned just previously. Under 100% auctioning, for example, what we're seeing is the percent change in output in the coal industry in the short run, that is 2 years after the policy is introduced, and in the longer term, and output is reduced by between 20 and 40% in those periods. And there's a very big change in profit under 100% auctioning. But if you move over to the next column, you'll see that if you just freely allocate about 8% or 7.8% of the allowances, there's no loss of profits, despite the fact that output is reduced by the same amount. And indeed, if you did 100% free allocation, you went to the other extreme, this would substantially overcompensate firms. Now, I don't want to bind myself or commit myself to this particular number that there's a 611% increase in profits. But I would say that the qualitative result is correct here, that you would substantially overcompensate if you freely allocated all the allowances. To save time, I won't mention what's also happening in the oil and gas industry, but the results are quite similar. So the bottom line here is that depending on how the method of allocation, it can make a very big difference to profits, and partial free allocation is sufficient. One other thing to notice, though, is that there's... what do we make from all this? Well, first point is that to make whole some of the affected industries, only a small fraction of the allowances have to be made given out free. And secondly, and this I think is a major sort of a main point here, is that there's other reasons to keep the auction component large, that is the free allocation component small. And I think some of the other speakers are going to be mentioning some of these other reasons. One reason is that you can use the revenues from an auction to contribute to other social goals, such as promoting or financing new technologies or research and development. So if you auction, the preponderance of the permits or the allowances, you get some revenues that can be used for that purpose. Second, as Gib Metcalf will probably illustrate, some of these revenues from an auction can be used to improve the distribution of impacts across households, to prevent serious impacts on certain households, or to at least cushion the distribution of impacts between low and higher income households. And third, importantly, as Terry already alluded, and as Dallas Bertrand will also discuss, you can use the revenues, potentially, at least in theory, to finance cuts in ordinary taxes. And by doing that, the economy runs more smoothly, the tax system introduces less distortion or deadweight loss. Now, we can all argue about how likely it is. Indeed, there's relatively little precedent for that kind of thing where you take the additional revenues and you actually earmark them for tax cuts. But if you were to do that, you'd get this additional benefit. So, two things to note. One, these goals that I've just mentioned through, let's say, 80-85% auctioning are also possible with 100% auctioning. Because under 85% auctioning or 15% free allocation, that directly will compensate the firms. But under 100% auctioning, you can also compensate the firms by taking some of the auction revenue and recycling it back to the firms. So 100% auctioning can also achieve that purpose. And that sort of makes even further the case that you should rely a lot on auctioning. And second point, just incidentally, is that a carbon tax would have very similar effects to 100% auctioning. So it has many of the virtues that we've mentioned here. So my final slide, which differs from the one that is on the handout, but I think it probably makes the point a little bit better, is that a policy that relies heavily on auctioning rather than freely allocating allowances, I think has a lot going for it. It's, first of all, it's consistent with protecting profits of major suppliers and users. You only need to freely allocate a small portion in order to protect profits of some major stakeholders. You can do it via free allocation of a little bit, or even by way of 100% auctioning where you take some of the revenues to compensate. And the second point, again, is that the revenue from an auction can also be used to promote other social goals, such as redistribution of household impacts, promotion of clean technologies, or the reduction in economy-wide cost to the extent that you can finance cuts in ordinary taxes like the income tax or sales taxes. So overall, I think the message here is not only that that allocation makes a huge difference and that it can compensate, but that relying principally on auctioning, I think, has a lot going for it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm going to draw on work of a lot of my colleagues at Resources for the Future that is woven into this, and I'm going to focus on the electricity sector. The reason for focusing on the electricity sector is that although electricity represents about 40% of the CO2 emissions in the nation, in most modeling, in the first decade or two of the program, the electricity sector is expected to be responsible for about 2/3 to 3/4 of the emission reductions we're likely to see. So that's why we'd focus there. And in terms of this title, I want to emphasize that we're looking at efficiency and distribution issues in the same context. Now, the usual paradigm you hear about in economics is that these two concepts butt against each other. But I think in this, what's unusual about the climate debate is they don't necessarily do so. In some cases, economic advice suggests policies that work in the same direction with respect to efficiency and distributional goals. And one way to think about this is that if, as may be the case in the next decade or two, we're asked to do as much as some suggest we're going to need to do by the way of carbon reductions, it could become very costly to do so. And many people have drawn attention to the fact that low-income households spend proportionally more of their energy bill or their household income on energy. And so therefore, it becomes increasingly expensive to achieve climate goals if we are not achieving those goals in an efficient manner. So achieving efficiency in the design of climate policy very much helps to achieve distributional goals, I will argue. But what is the academic advice on the distribution of emission allowances? The economics literature broadly finds, as Larry already set out, there are significant advantages to auctioning emission allowances. So I'll ask, without trying to review that again now, why would we give any allowances away for free? And I think there's at least three prominent reasons why we might give some emission allowances away for free. One is to achieve compensation goals. But as Larry pointed out helpfully already, 100% free allocation can dramatically overcompensate the affected firms, and that comes at the expense of consumers and raises concerns about equity, the so-called windfall profits concern. And also, at least in the electricity sector, modeling indicates that consumers bear about 8 times the cost of the impact on producers. So if we want to give away allowances for free, the question is to whom should the allowances should be given. A second justification may be to promote technology. And a third would be to protect competition, especially in those sectors of the economy that are exposed to foreign competition. I also, coincidentally, emphasize the same point that Larry concluded with, that all of these goals could be achieved with auction revenue rather than with free allocation of emission allowances. And one of the virtues of that approach is you avoid the sense of entitlement to perpetual free allocation to emission allowances if there is a dedication of revenue during some transition period and putting climate policy into place. So I'm going to look now at what happens in the electricity sector, and the really difficult issue facing policymakers is the regional differences that exist across the country because different regions have different emission intensity of electricity generation, and even more importantly, the differences in the nature of regulation in the electricity sector implies different cost recovery rules and different impacts on firms. So first, let's look just at those regions of the country that have competitive based wholesale electricity prices, which roughly the nation is divided in half the nation being competitive and half the nation using traditional cost of service rate recovery. So this is a graph that portrays what would happen under the relatively modest original NSEP Bingaman proposal from a couple years ago in the competitive regions of the country. And I've displayed along the horizontal axis here the change in the value of firms. You can think of this as an instantaneous change in the value on Wall Street were this policy to be put into place. And first, let's look at the red, which would represent free allocation to generators. Under free allocation to generators, I'm drawing these results from a detailed, highly parameterized simulation model of the electricity sector that solves for capacity planning and retirement and dispatch of the system out into the future on a regional basis in the U.S. And we see that virtually every firm, and these firms are then the megawatts of capacity as owned by firms are arrayed to the right here, and we see that under free allocation, the vast majority, virtually all of the firms are gaining in value under free allocation in competitive regions of the country. If we move instead to upstream allocation, which could be an auction or allocation for free at fuel supply level, or equivalently from the perspective of the electricity sector, this would be an auction, could be an auction to the electricity sector or an auction generally, then the distribution shifts to the left. And although on net there are negative costs on the profitability of the industry, you still find nearly 50% of the industry still managing to receive a gain in value, even under an auction. So we want to ask, why could this be the case? Well, taking a look at this NSEP Bingaman proposal again, And I've arrayed here, imagine that there's a change in market value of individual assets portrayed along the horizontal axis, and this vertical line represents a break-even point. And this little cartoon shows an array of coal plants, nuclear plants, gas plants, renewable plants, wind turbines, some of these facilities are going to lose value, some of these facilities are going to gain value. Because, for example, if you're running a non-emitting facility, then the increase in product price associated with complying with the program means you're going to receive more revenue from electricity generation without having to incur any regulatory costs. And then natural gas plants are going to have relatively lower emission rates than coal plants, et cetera. So there's going to be an array of facilities in terms of the change in instantaneous market value at the individual facility level. The losing facilities, in this case, in the net present value terms, would lose about $50 billion. In other words, when someone pleads that they have a facility that's going to really be hurt under even a modest climate policy, I believe them. Because a lot of facilities are going to get creamed under any kind of climate policy. And there's another class of facilities that are going to instantaneously recognize an increase in value. And in this case, it's about $41 billion compared to $50 billion in net present value at losing facilities. The net present value under this modest policy that doesn't start for a few years out, so that's why this might look like sort of a smaller number than you're used to seeing, would be $141 billion in terms of the net present value of CO2 emission allowances. And the losses at the industry level are going to be $9 billion. Now, these losses are all concentrated in regions of the country where there's competitive electricity markets because we are presuming in this simulation modeling that regulators perform according to textbook regulation and under cost of service regulation and maintain returns to invested capital for investor-owned utilities in those portions of the country where there's regulation. So if you believe that regulators are going to behave like that, and some firms have trepidation that, well, maybe they won't behave like that, but if regulators behave like that, then all these changes in value are going to be concentrated in competitive regions of the country. And we can see that some of these facilities are going to be, when you aggregate them, there are going to be some firms that on net are going to break, are going to end up losing money, and some firms that are going to end up winning, making money. Losing firms here lose about $14 billion in value, and winning firms would gain about $5 billion in value. Putting the specific numbers aside, when we look at different policies with different types of stringency, the same general pattern emerges. So when it comes to questions of compensation, we can see that compensation at the firm level is different than compensating at the individual facility level. And here, in this case, compensation can be achieved with just 7% of the emission allowances on an industry-wide basis. If you target only the losers, it's about 11% of allowance value. So this has been a look at shareholders, but as I said, the majority of the impact falls on consumers. And I'm going to look at a different, some more recent modeling based on the McCain-Lieberman example, and we're looking at electricity price effects because it's changes in electricity prices that are going to affect consumers. And under 100% auction, with a break-even point being right here, and the nation divided into competitive regions and regulated regions of the country, there's going to be a difference across regions of the country because of the difference in the carbon intensity of electricity generation across regions. But there's sort of a fairly even distribution with respect to those regions of the country that have regulation and those that have competitive markets. But what happens with free allocation producers? In this case, you'll see a big shift to the left here, for those regions of the country where there is cost of service electricity regulation, because costs are based on original costs, and if producers are receiving allowances at a zero original cost, they're going to pass through zero costs for their regulatory costs on to ratepayers in changes in electricity prices. So this idea of free allocation introduces a whole new conundrum that there's sort of basically a north-south split, if you will, but basically you're going to have half of the country experiencing much more dramatic changes in electricity prices than the other half of the country. With free allocation across the industry and given the current organization of electricity regulation. So a new idea that we've been looking at recently is to do with the allocation to load. What if instead of giving allowances away for free to generators, you were going to give allowances to load-serving entities who would then factor those allowances into the rate base and calculating costs that are going to be charged to consumers? Well, this recovers symmetry, but now provides, instead of a windfall to electricity producers, it provides a windfall to electricity consumers in the context of climate policy. So this is this picture, by the way, I apologize, is different than this, what's in your handout, because that was my mistake, and I fixed that slide. So this is the correct slide, and it's the same picture I just had down below before. So now, to compare, I'm showing you what we had before when we looked at free allocation to generators based on emissions. And now I want to contrast that with allocation to load. This recovers the symmetry, and now we see basically a distribution that's sort of even between regulated and competitive regions of the country, with a shift to the left. However, we will see that allowance prices, in order to achieve this level of emission reductions in the electricity sector, allowance prices are going to rise by as much as 15%. Or in an economy-wide policy, that means there's going to be less emission reductions achieved in the electricity sector or more reductions that have to be achieved outside the electricity sector because of this windfall to consumers. That is, electricity prices are not going to rise in a way that reflects the scarcity value of carbon in the economy, while we might be expected to see that in other sectors of the economy. Okay. So free distribution to electricity consumers can have significant efficiency costs also. Now, I don't want to advocate a sudden change in electricity price, both because that's economically disruptive and politically unsupportable. But a permanent allocation to load constitutes a windfall consumers through a subsidy to electricity prices, and this will have its own costs. So my closing comment is that a parochial assignment of value or subsidy of prices to one sector of the economy will lead to different marginal costs and different levels of effort across the economy. And this is likely to raise tremendously the cost of achieving carbon goals. And it's going to greatly increase the social costs of climate policy, which is going to not only have efficiency consequences, but distributional consequences. So a closing thought of a candidate of an idea that we might work with here is that allocation to load may be a transition tool that can help us ease in the change in prices in the electricity sector as we transition into an auction to achieve climate goals. Thank you.
Great. Well, it's a pleasure to be here today talking about this issue. So I'm going to focus one other slice at this issue, focus on the household impacts of forward shifting of the burden of carbon pricing. Speakers before me have both pointed out the extent to which cap and trade system could lead to higher prices to the extent that the cost of permits is being passed forward into higher consumer prices. And so I just start by reminding everyone what we've been already saying this morning, which is that while we certainly understand that taxes have a burden, that there is an economic burden of taxes that falls on individuals, whether it's in their role as consumers or as supplying factors of production, cap and trade systems also have a burden, as we've been talking about. So we can think about this. Equivalently, that if we use a tax approach or if we use a cap and trade approach, it does lead to higher costs, with some caveats for thinking about regulated sectors like electricity. And so the question then is, if we have carbon pricing, whether it's in the form of a cap and trade system or carbon taxes, what's the impact on individuals, households? Is this regressive or progressive? And so what I have done is what I'm going to present here is the results of some work using data from year 2003, thinking about a cap and trade system that has a permit price of $15 per ton applied to the fossil fuel sector. And so I have used data from the input-output accounts in BEA to trace through the energy price impact so that we can think about not only the direct price impacts, the cost of electricity, higher cost of electricity, gasoline, home heating fuels, but also the higher costs of other commodities that use energy in their production. So the cost of food goes up, the cost of buying an automobile goes up. And we'd like to trace through those price impacts as well as the direct fuel price impacts. And so the price impacts that I can calculate through the input-output accounts, we can then link to households through the consumer expenditure survey, so we can then think about distributional impacts. And I'm going to talk today, in the distributional analysis I'll discuss here, I'm going to focus on a completely forward shifting of the prices, though I've done some work. Some of the slides are actually in the handout, but I've done some work with the joint program on the science and policy of global change at MIT, thinking through how results change if we think about some backward shifting. And I'm also doing some work with Kevin Hassett at AEI, thinking through different measures of incidence using lifetime rather than annual income measures. And the kind of results, the basic story is going to be unchanged, though the degree of the distributional patterns will change a little bit. So if we do this forward shifting, if we think that most of the price impact of carbon pricing is going to show up in higher prices, what is the impact on households? And for the moment, I want to ignore what are we doing with the allowances. Set that aside for the moment. And this is the burden of permit costs through the higher price of fuels on households. And so I've divided the households up into 10 household income deciles, with the poorest households on the left and the richest households on the right. And what we see is that the higher expenditures because of carbon pricing, both the direct expenditures on fuel and the increased indirect expenditures on other goods, it looks quite regressive. It's about 3.5% increased spending, 3.5% of income for the poorest households, and declining to a little less than 1% for the richest households in the data. This is if we were applying, again, this is if we were applying a cap-and-trade system with a $15 permit on the economy in the year 2003, given the carbon emissions and spending patterns in that year. Now, I haven't distributed the value of the permits yet, so I want to think about then, well, what if we were to go with auctioning? There are a variety of things we could do with the revenue. It would be in 2003, it would be revenue on the order of $80 billion a year. And so I want to describe a proposal that I recently discussed in a Hamilton Project paper. Here we're going to rebate the revenue to households through an environmental earned income tax credit. So the idea is that workers are paying payroll taxes. There's the employee portion of the tax that they're paying directly, and there's the portion being paid by employers. But economists, typically the modeling shows that the employer portion is actually borne by workers in the form of lower wages. And so we're providing an environmental earned income tax credit up to $560. That's the amount that would just offset the amount of revenue with the auction permits. And if we do that, we find the following. So this is the burden of the permit costs I showed you before, the regressive burden. Here's the distribution of the rebate in the form of the environmental earned income tax credit. I'm tying it to earned income to get a little bit of efficiency impact in the form of incentives to increase work effort, primarily in the decision to enter the workforce for secondary workers. And what you find is that the rebate is moderately progressive. Lower income households are getting greater benefits from this as a percentage of income than richer households. And if we put it together, it is, over most of the distribution, distributionally neutral. Now, the bottom 20% of the households, which are households with less than $16,000-$17,000 in household income, there is a net positive burden. This is where the non-workers are. But this is slightly overstated because I have not taken into account the indexing of Social Security benefits, and many of those recipients are in those two deciles. But we can tweak the proposal a little bit. So the proposal, as I modeled it, is only providing the environmental earned income tax credit to workers, but we can also provide a benefit to recipients of Social Security that's equal to the maximum tax credit. And if we do that, it lowers, using the 2003 data, it would lower the maximum credit and subsidy to Social Security recipients from $560 to $420, because we're spreading it out over more people. But if you do that, then the auction with rebate combination is modestly progressive, using an annual income analysis. So the point is that we have a policy that is that the carbon pricing by itself is going to be quite regressive, but we can undo that through careful use of the revenues. And I want to contrast that to the impact with grandfathering. If we give the permits all out for free, Larry has already talked about sort of the industry impacts. The recipients, the beneficiaries of grandfathering, are going to be owners of equity. Owners of equity, capital owners, are in the higher income brackets, and so when you take that into account, then you get a distinctly regressive impact from the policy. So the points to take away from this is that carbon pricing, setting aside what we do with revenues, we can think of grandfathering as we've collected the revenue and then given it out again. Carbon pricing by itself is regressive, and while I didn't talk about it, it continues to be regressive if we use a lifetime analysis or if we think about different assumptions on forward and backward shifting. It may not be quite as regressive, but it's still regressive. But we can undo that through well-designed rebate of carbon revenue. Grandfathering exacerbates the revenue, and we can use the revenue from auctioning for distributional purposes. But there is this broader point that revenue provides fiscal flexibility that is lost with grandfathering. I've been focusing on distribution, but you may be interested in efficiency issues. You may be interested in integrating the corporate and personal income tax to get rid of the double taxation of capital income. Or you may want to pay for the alternative minimum tax fix. Revenue provides fiscal flexibility to address any number of these important problems. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you for inviting me today, and it's a privilege to represent the work of my colleagues, Dale and Pete and Dan and Mun, and it's also a privilege to join my distinguished colleagues here on this panel. What I'm aiming to do today is there's a whole wave of these general equilibrium models that have been brought to bear on climate change issues, and so I'm sort of here to represent not only our model, but some of the features that are common among these models that can address the whole issue of equity and distribution in terms of allocation. Larry wrote an article or a paper several years ago where he talked about the dual nature of the externalities associated with climate change, a technology externality being one of them in terms of underinvestment in technologies that are going to solve the problem. Mispricing is the second externality. And we seem to have a situation here where, all climate change is global, and of course, being in this distinguished place, we recognize that all politics is local. And therein sort of lies the problem with related to climate change policies associated with the mispricing solutions. The costs are near-term, they're intuitive, they're certain, and they're focused on job loss, income loss, relative efficiencies across instruments, and fairness. When we look at the benefits side, there are still a lot of these benefits floating around, but the benefits get woven into a whole lot of quality of life issues that are neither market-based issues, nor are they monetized. Even if they're market-based, they aren't monetized. So the question is, what have we learned with these policies? There's a wave of these policies that have hit since the 2006 elections. Some 21 some odd bills are floating around in various stages of markup and consideration. And so when we look at these, they've become increasingly ambitious as we've learned more about the problem, as the modelers and the analysis has brought, and the science has brought more to the fore. The policies are much more ambitious than Kyoto. I mean, we're looking at emissions reductions, you know, cumulative emissions reductions of 40 to 50 to 60% as you go way out. This is huge. And so this is a lot bigger than the Clean Air Act and a lot bigger than SO2. So these are big policies which have big effects. So I want to look at the focus on the graphs here. Even with these more aggressive policies, the economic impacts are relatively small at the macro level. We're talking about, you know, 10, 15, 20 basis points shaving off of economic growth. The economy is still going to grow. But the big question is, you got a bunch of industries, relatively small ones, that get hit very, very hard. Electric sector, coal. It's not uncommon in these models to see coal prices going up by 100%, 200%, 500% as you get further out with these policies. So certain industries get hit a lot. It's sort of interesting to know, to look economy-wide, yes, the electric sector and the coal industry and the petroleum mining industry, they get hit relatively hard, but some of the bigger costs are borne by high-tech manufacturing and trade in dollar terms. So big industries that are obviously concentrated as the problem, the source of the problem with emissions and climate change, are not the ones that are going to necessarily bear the largest dollar costs associated with climate change. If we look at who bears the burden of these costs in our methodology, by and large, capital and labor income share the burden almost equally. In some cases, in some industries, equities, shareholders get a bigger hit in terms of their income effects and how they're going to how that's going to show up in stock prices. In other cases, labor takes the biggest hit. There are some exceptions, though. Coal, electric utilities, oil and gas, the capital side, the equity shareholders are going to be experiencing the larger costs associated with this. So the next question is there anything that sort of mitigates or moderates the costs to these various sectors and to the economy as a whole? And the first thing, obviously, is, well, these kinds of policies, because they're so big, they're going to be unleashing a wave of forces that are directed at product innovation and process innovation. So it's not only going to be input substitution and output reductions. There's going to be technological change. The question is, how big is this likely to be? Well, the answer is, the technological change, price-induced or policy-induced technological change, is in fact going to help us. It is going to moderate the cost of climate change policy, but not by very much. A little bit for the economy as a whole, but principally the household sector is going to benefit. In the absence of induced technical change in our calculations, the household sector costs to consumption would be 20 to 25% higher than they are in the presence of induced technical change. It's a mixture, though. Certain industries like the electric utilities and motor vehicles and crude oil and gas extraction, they're going to see a lot of technical change that's going to help the sector. It's going to mitigate against the price increases and the output losses that the sector faces. But there are other sectors like services and construction and agriculture where the policy is going to unleash forces that actually work against the sector. Prices are going to be higher in the presence of ITC. Output effects are going to be larger in the presence of ITC. Overall, ITC helps, but it's going to be a mixture of stories at the sort of meso-micro level, and you're going to have to sort that out. It's not the case that these are necessarily wired in. This is not the gospel truth here, but this is certainly a measure that looks at the historic past of technical change, taking that on into the future, and then shocking the system with the kinds of price effects that we're going to see. Is there anything else that can help? Well, you know, as the panel has already suggested, we can use the revenues in some fashion or another to basically redistribute the permit revenues back to the various sectors. So let's think about the issues there. Well, we've got several different analyses that we've done over the years that look at the issue of recycling permit revenues. One analysis we did involves social cost energy pricing, which is a mixture of climate change policies and traditional particulate matter policies. Another analysis we did several years ago involves carbon mitigation, a carbon policy associated with revenue recycling. And depending on which metric of welfare one chooses, either pure household consumption of goods and services or household consumption of goods and services, where you factor in expenditure on discretionary leisure, which is the one that most economists prefer, and in fact is the one that sits on top of most of these general equilibrium models, you get a different story. And when you're using pure consumption, lump sum redistributions are the worst possible way to reallocate permit revenues. You're much better off using capital taxes or marginal labor taxes or personal taxes. When you shift the story to full consumption, where you're talking about goods and services and leisure, the story changes, and there capital taxation turns out to be a preferred recycling mechanism, either corporate taxes or more broadly capital taxes, featuring non-corporate taxes, non-corporate capital taxes, and household capital taxes. Lump sum is going to change a bit because you've got leisure stories woven into this. So in figuring out distribution, when we start looking at welfare effects, when we go to the level of consumption in our model, not at the level of full consumption, but we're at the level of consumption, we have a richer way of demographic detail that allows us to look at welfare impacts both at the societal level and at the individual level. Broad story is, at the societal level, climate change policies are regressive, without question, unambiguous. It's very difficult to find any circumstances where climate change policy, even with redistribution in these typical CGE models, is going to turn out to be welfare improving equality. The equality just isn't going to be there. And we see that when we look at the individual level in terms of ranking policies from the least severe to the most beneficial. The high income people bear the least cost. The lower income people bear the greatest cost. When a recycling benefit turns out to be the case, it turns out that the high-income people benefit more, the lower-income people benefit least. I want to switch quickly to benefits. Regardless of what policy you look at, what cost-side policy you look at, that story stands pretty much the same. The interesting thing is when you look at the benefits side, looking at when you talk about agricultural impacts, sea level rises, coastal protection, air quality protection, you see that when, in fact, climate change occurs, it is harmful to equality. There's an equality loss. It worsens the distribution of income. So that means that if you're implementing climate change policy, you get an equality loss from the policy itself, but you're avoiding damages that gives you an equality gain. Timing still matters. The timing's going to be radically different on benefits and costs. Now, unfortunately, in the CGE models, and I'll close with this, we have this representative consumer sitting at the top. And, you know, it reminds me of the quip, you know, time is what prevents everything from happening at once, and space is what prevents it from happening to you. Well, in the case of these CGE models, you've got this representative consumer. So even though we've got separation by industry, or in the case of the MIT model and the Adage model and other models, you have separation by industry and by region and by nations, you still wind up with this representative consumer at the top. So everything is still happening to you. And so the consequences here, you have to get down to the level of distribution where you actually have mechanisms, as Gibbs says, mechanisms where you can redistribute this by income to solve this equity issue. You're not going to see these kinds of analyses at the sort of the aggregate CGE model that's going to show anything other than these policies being regressive.
Thank you. At this point, I'd like to just go ahead and open up to questions from the floor. I have several questions myself, but I'm going to give you all first opportunity and might just chime in as we go along. Yes, back here. If you could just stand and identify yourself and
ask a question.
This is just an administrative question, process question. Many of these slides are not easily viewed unless you're in color. Do you have any plans to put these electronically on the CBO website?
I think they already are.
They already are, yeah.
That was easy. Okay. Here, right here.
versus the regulated utilities and consumers. That was probably collected really fast.
Do you want to repeat the question, or just to make sure everybody heard it?
Okay.
Is that? There's no switch as far as I can tell.
It's on the wall. Someone's coming to fix it.
Do you want to just step up here, Dennis?
Well, leave it on for now. I'll take this one from here, and then the panel can... I could go on and on answering that question, and you don't want me to do that. But the question was, could I repeat and explain a little further the nature of the impacts on in competitive and versus regulated regions of the country? So very briefly, I'll try to do so in just two or three sentences. The key issue is that in those portions of the country where there's still traditional cost of service regulation, regulators are expected to set retail electricity prices in order to recover all costs for the regulated investor-owned utility. So cost of service regulation means that all costs go in and get divided by kilowatt hours of sales to come up with an average price, roughly speaking. That's the way it works. And in that regulatory framework, everything is accounted for at original cost. So if in original cost was an auction, then the value of emission allowances at their auction value would get folded into total costs that have to be recovered through in the rate base. If allowances were given away for free, then original cost is zero to the IOU, and so a cost of zero would be folded in to total costs, and that leads to a lower electricity price if there is free allocation to generators in regulated regions of the country. But in competitive regions of the country, it doesn't work that way. In competitive regions of the country, we expect electricity prices to be determined at the margin based on what generators bid into the wholesale power market, and that reflects opportunity costs. So it doesn't matter how generators acquire their allowances in the first place with respect to what their opportunity costs are of generation, because whether they have to go out into the market and buy an allowance, or they have an allowance in the bank, if you will, and they have to use it, but that allowance has an alternative value in that they could sell it. In either case, the opportunity cost of electricity generation is the same. So in competitive regions of the country, we would expect to see electricity generators bidding at opportunity cost, and that's not going to differ whether they had to pay for their emission allowances on an auction or receive them for free. I hope that helps.
All right, we're going to try this alternative microphone. Does that have interference now?
Jeff Hopkins, if there, I think I have a question for the first presenter. If you could just talk a little bit more about what sort of distributional rules you would use for your 10% allocation. I assume it's not 10% of what you would have gotten in a whole free allocation. But I'm wondering if you could just, I would hope you're not using the ex post outcomes to determine how you would ex ante distribute the allowance. Because that would be a lot of information requirement on behalf of Congress to put that in place before.
I'll repeat the question. The question is, under free allocation, if I understand correctly, is under free allocation, what would be the rule?
Under the 10%. You had three scenarios, right? You had a full auction, a full allocation, and 10%.
Okay, but that was under 10% free allocation. That portion, which is free, is 10%. How would you allocate those free allowances across industries? That's a very tough question. I'm not sure that I can propose a perfect rule because there's a lot of information that would be required to allocate those free allowances in accordance, just in a way that would neutralize the profit losses to all industries or to all firms within industries. Firms differ. Some are going to suffer higher costs than others. In my view, I think a coarse approach would be one where you get a sense of the average profit loss for different firms, and you do it on the basis of what you expect ex ante would be necessary in order to make industries whole. Make the entities whole. But as Dallas's presentation indicated, there is a lot of heterogeneity, and I don't think it's realistic to expect that under free allocation you could do it just right so that you could make every every firm home. Another way to do it, which might be a rough approximation, would be to do it based on the relative output of the different industries. So the proportionally larger, relative firms. So the proportionally larger firms would receive proportionally more free allowances. But of course, that's not going to do it perfectly either. There's going to be some smaller firms that really would require a greater proportion of allowances. I think if we hold out for a perfect method, that there's going to be no method at all because the information requirements are severe. So I think that's a real problem. And by the way, under 100% auctioning, it's a problem as well, because there you have the issue of trying to compensate by using the auction revenues. So in any case, I think there's not going to be any perfect way to ensure that you exactly may hold all the entities involved.
Hi, I'm Adele Morris with the Joint Economic Committee. A comment and a question. We haven't talked about the tax treatment of freely allocated allowances. And under current tax law, this would not be considered taxable income. And so it's a question whether or not that's the policy, you know, whether that policy would apply to carbon allowances. And it's important for two reasons, both because there's a foregone recapture of the value of the allowances, and at a 33% marginal corporate income tax rate, that's a lot of money. Plus, it creates a cost basis of $0 for those allowances, which could potentially impede the secondary market, because firms would face a capital gains tax on the entire value of the allowances. So I would just invite the panel and others who think about these policies to consider the tax treatment of freely allocated allowances. My question is, to the extent that we want an efficiency-enhancing but progressive tax reform that mitigates the regressivity of the carbon price, what, maybe this is for Gib or Richard, what do you think would be the best options to get as much efficiency gains as you can while trying to make the policy more incidence neutral?
Let me try to tackle the first comment. There are two components to think about in permits that are given away or allocated initially at no cost. The first is what impact it would have on corporate income tax collection. And to the extent that the effects that we, that the other people on this panel have already highlighted, that is that there would be a significant increase in corporate profits that resulted from free allocation of the funds that would get picked up by the corporate income tax under current law, basically because the prices that the firms would charge would go up and their average cost would not, and therefore their profits would, which is the point that Larry Goulder was making. And many of the analyses have incorporate that effect into their overall analysis by having some sort of feedback loop through which the additional corporate income tax revenue collected is then used for various different purposes. I would note quickly my second point, which is a scoring point, that effect of additional corporate income tax revenue is a macroeconomic phenomena that would generally not be incorporated into a CBO or a Joint Committee on Taxation scoring of a carbon proposal. There is, however, a separate and important scoring issue involving permits that are given away. And that is that given that the market for permits is projected to be somewhere between $50 and $300 billion a year by 2020 under most of the proposals that are out there, the secondary market in the permits would be very deep and liquid. And there is a solid argument to be made that giving a permit away that's worth $100 when that permit can be immediately sold for $100 is effectively equivalent to the government giving away the $100, and therefore that should be reflected as an outlay and a corresponding revenue. So in other words, if you give away a permit worth $100, the transaction is effectively equivalent to selling the permit for $100 and then giving the recipient to whom you had given the permit $100 in cash. And CBO is currently nearing its nearing a decision on whether that would be a more appropriate scoring than the traditional scoring. It is important to realize the federal budget is primarily a cash-based document, and most scoring, therefore, is based on cash transactions. Traditional scoring of permits that are given away, since it may be a quasi-cash transaction, it's not literally a cash transaction, would not incorporate that as an outlay. But given the depth and liquidity of the secondary market, again, there is an argument that could be made that that would be a more appropriate scoring treatment in this case, and CBO will soon be forced to make a final decision on that scoring issue.
Can I just ask a follow-up? How
do
they handle the
In the sulfur dioxide trading program, the scoring of the permits that were given away in that program were excluded from the federal budget. So in other words, they were not scored as an outlay and a revenue.
I guess I'm asking if you knew why that was chosen,
Well, I think I think, again, it reflects the fact that fundamentally the federal budget is primarily a cash-based thing. And the scoring traditionally is cash-based. And when you give a permit away, especially in a market that is somewhat less liquid and deep, it's less of a cash transaction. There are some observers who believe that even that scoring decision was inappropriate and would have been better to score it as an outlay of a revenue. But even if you don't reach that conclusion, there are important differences between the sulfur dioxide system and the potential carbon system, just in the scope and scale of the overall program. So even if one believes that the sulfur dioxide program should be scored in a traditional way, i.e. excluded from the budget to the extent that permits are given away, that conclusion need not necessarily carry over to a much larger and more liquid system that would apply to carbon.
Adele had a question too, which was, how do we get the right balance between efficiency and equity, as I understand your question, in designing the return of auction revenue? And so the proposal that I discussed was one that really focused on distributional neutrality, but clearly if you want, there is a tension here. If you want to get the greatest efficiency gains, you're probably going to want to look at using the revenue for reducing capital income taxation at the margin. But if you're trying to get some balance between the two, then you can do something more in the income tax in terms of lowering rates across the board, or lowering payroll tax rates across the board to reduce taxation on labor.
Picking up on that too, in the models that we use, the CGE models, there's a presumption here, as it turns out, that lump sum redistributions, if you give away all the permits for free and have a deficit neutral tax policy where you're using lump sum redistributions, there's no difference between giving all the permits away and then having a deficit neutral tax policy to recover, to bring the deficit back into a position, whatever the base case position is of the deficit, or having the government auction all the permits off and then have lump sum reductions in tax rates. In these CGE models, basically all income accrues to the household sector as either employees or shareholders. So, the corporate tax basically is sort of an indirect tax on household income, basically through their corporate ownership, through that portion of capital income that's corporate-based. So, to answer your second question, the efficiency, you could certainly use capital taxes that are directed at the households in terms of pension redistribution, that kind of thing, as Gibb has indicated, there are a lot of distributional policies that you can use that wouldn't detract seriously at all from the efficiency consequences of the policy.
I had just one more thing on the offsetting tax changes, because many people have noted that within Congress, jurisdiction for those tax changes may reside in a different committee than jurisdiction for the cap and trade system itself, and therefore raise questions about the degree to which there's any political economy feasibility of this sort of combination. And that is a legitimate issue to be highlighting. But one thing I would note is to the extent that permits are auctioned and the revenue is used for deficit reduction, and to the extent that we do face a very significant long-term fiscal problem, that those amounts that are used for deficit reduction that avert any potential future tax increases are equivalent to that combo move that people are talking about. That is to say, if on our current fiscal path various taxes would be raised and you avert that from happening, then the combination of the policy, even without a specific move by the relevant committees on taxes, is analytically equivalent to what some of these proposals involve.
Yes.
The last speaker, can you talk a little bit about the regressivity of basically any climate policy, but can you also talk about sort of the disproportionate impact of climate impacts on low-income households? Has anyone done analysis that monetized what those impacts are and what the relative distribution of regressivity policy versus non-active? That's an important balancing test.
Yeah, it is, and I would agree, but I think the issue is, to my knowledge, there hasn't been a lot of stuff done on the welfare implications where you include leisure, and I think that's an important ingredient in the overall story. And so, specifically in terms of looking at the benefit side, the timing is going to be the key difference on the benefit side, because the redistributional impacts of the costs are going to be nearer term, and the progressivity of the benefits of the damages avoided are going to be much longer term. So even if you were able to reconcile the timing differences in a sort of an overlapping generations model, which is not what these CGE models are, that's going to really tell the story. And I think that's just, the research is not there yet. It's just not even close.
Yes.
And it's not a rule of the practical difference. That is a kind of follow-up question, a previous one, and my question is to the future. Yes, climate benefits will be huge, but do you consider immediate ancillary benefits, like, for example, avoided infant mortality and morbidity rates as ancillary result of climate policy, because I think if we have comprehensive data distribution of the house cost, if you consider that by analysis of ancillary benefits, you will realize that quite a substantial chunk of those losses could be offset by immediate ancillary benefits. So this is the question. Of course, talking about climate benefits, we need to take into account uncertainties and the cocktail distribution of catastrophic events. What can you say regarding that?
Okay, the first question was, did we consider any ancillary benefits in looking at the policy changes in terms of health morbidity? We have done an analysis where we've looked at that. We haven't done an equity calculation based on that. As it turns out, though, the biggest thing for the U.S. is agriculture. Agriculture swamps everything else in terms of benefits and costs to climate change or avoided damages. It's just enormous. And so as a consequence, even if you have some significant improvements in health and morbidity, it turns out that the agriculture story swamps whatever those benefits are. And to look at uncertainty, what we've done is we've done a survey of the literature to look at the best case scenarios for agriculture and health and other types of things and the worst case scenarios, and then we've married that to alternative climate projections to sort of capture the range. And if you look at the benefit side and the cost side of climate change, climate change can either be short-run beneficial for the economy. Ultimately, it's harmful. Ultimately, agriculture pulls the whole thing into a cost side where climate change turns out to be costly for the economy. So, in essence, what you wind up is harm is going to take place. It's just a matter of when. And that harm is clearly regressive to expenditure. But agriculture is the whole story. And in terms of catastrophic
We have not done anything related to sort of looking at, all of a sudden a catastrophic economic event and what that would do. We haven't done anything like that. Most of the stuff we do is sort of smooth and phased.
On the issue of ancillary benefits, there was a study that was done, commissioned by the US EPA some years back by Joel Sharada. It was ultimately published in the National Tax Journal, where they did, in fact, look at ancillary benefits. And they found in that study that over the whole time frame, the ancillary benefits corresponded to about 25%, were about one quarter the size of all the climate change benefits over the whole time horizon. But the timing changes, it makes a big difference, because in the short term, almost all the benefits are the ancillary benefits. It's over the longer term that the climate benefits really occur. So they under that study, it's now fairly old, it might have been almost 10 years ago, but the ancillary benefits were considered quite significant. And I know that in the recent IPCC report, there is a discussion of ancillary benefits, and I imagine it relates to some more, it can refer to some more recent studies.
Charlie Garlow, Senator Sanders' office. I was wondering about the directionality of the number, the first speaker, or since the cake, I think, is 100% perfect, but is there a change in the magic or sweet spot for partial allocation of 7 instead of being 7.8%? If we find that there is, over time, greater cuts or more induced efficiencies in technology, does this number change if we're phasing it in?
Yes, I'll repeat the question. The question is a magic number of 7.8356%. Then, or let's say somewhere between 10 and 20%. How does that number change over time? First, to explain what that number is, that is the percentage which, if maintained over time, of allowances that if given out free over time, always at that percentage, would in present value terms make whole the industries involved. So in some years, it may undercompensate, in others it would overcompensate, but over the entire time frame, it's just enough to make things whole. So already there's an issue of that number changing, even absent any other sort of exogenous shifts to the economic environment. I guess the best thing I can say is to say that percentage is, as Gib Metcalf suggested, it really depends on what share of the gross cost can be passed forward and shifted away from the firm toward the ultimate consumers. And in the long run, you can say that that's going to be greater because capital will be less trapped. Capital can ultimately adjust, supply curves become more elastic. There's more of a cost pass-through. So in some long-run sense, you would need to give out a smaller percentage because there's really a much greater cost pass-through. Whereas in the short term, capital is trapped, supply elasticities are very small. In that case, in the short term, firms are likely to not be able to pass on a big share of the cost. So that would suggest that in the short term, you would need to use a higher number. Now, to complicate things somewhat further, as Gib Metcalf reminded me this morning, there's an opposite effect also in that in the short term on the demand side, there's relatively inelastic demands, whereas over the long term, consumers can substitute more. So that has the opposite effect. My feeling is that the first effect I'm talking about on the supply side would dominate, but that's an empirical way.
Yes.
My question to Peter and one comment, Peter was talking about deficit reduction. Government is a very large consumer of energy, and they plan on problems in a large consumer of country. So as prices rise, government losses rise, and if not taken into account, whatever revenue we're taking in, we're all given out for other purposes. We can have a big increase in the deficit. The government's increased wealth. So the question is, is CEO planning to do some more work to try to quantify the various levels of emission reduction, what the impact might be on government costs from government's role in consumer energy? The comment relates to Gilbert Metcalf's interesting discussion of the environmental impact on tax credit. seems to us very interesting as far as it goes, but to have one significant weakness if it's not suffering. That being that if you look at the bottom 25 of America, over a third of them neither have earnings nor received Social Security. So if they were left out, you would end up having climate change legislation cause probably a bigger increase in poverty than any other sort of policy in the last 30 or 40 years. You have millions of people as consumers experiencing significant increases in cost, but being completely left out on the relief. So I don't think it's hard to address. We have a paper on our website where we suggest a combination of some kind of increase in the area of tax credit, maybe through congressionally, I think, through other payroll tax, and that depends on how high up the income scale you go. But combining that with a low-income climate change region that could be delivered through the electronic medical transfer system that every state in the country already has, where they issue debit cards as a way to deliver a food stamp and some other benefits along the house. Every state in the country could easily program all of their debit cards and say that everybody who either gets food stamps or the long-term subsidy and the medical prescription drug benefit, and once they climate change do that, you can design it and discuss it with you. So it coordinates with environmental energy contact there. So one phase is down and the other phase is up. And we estimate that we could probably reach well over 90% of the low-income households, offset the average impact on those households of climate change legislation, and provide significant relief to the next to the bottom quintile as well. But only about 13% of folks, which is not that significant. But the point is simply that there will be a problem if we leave out everybody at the bottom, people who have the least means, who doesn't either have earnings or receive Social Security. Unemployed people with disabilities or injuries that they can't work, mothers to carry their children who are really poor.
So I'll deal with the first question and then I'm often faced with the dichotomy between reality and scoring. And so I will, again, just highlight that from a scoring perspective, which many in the room may care about, almost all of the effects that one would anticipate on the federal government itself would be in discretionary spending, that is the Pentagon and the cost of heating the Capitol and what have you. And because discretionary spending is set year by year, we do not incorporate any effect of higher energy prices, for example, on future discretionary spending and evaluating, for example, a proposal for a cap and trade system. Now, in reality, there would be some additional pressure on those discretionary accounts, and the question is, would they be offset elsewhere within those discretionary accounts, or would the Congress appropriate more money for, say, the Pentagon to offset the additional costs of carbon charges? And CBO, in some of its distributional analysis in the past, has had to incorporate some of those effects into the analysis in order to make it as accurate as possible. And if and when we do update that analysis, we will update the assumptions about the effects on the government. Beyond that, I suppose if there are lots of members and staff from the Senate and the House here who are asked to look in more detail at what the effects on different departments could be, I suppose we could undertake something like that, but obviously it's a very complicated undertaking.
I'll just comment that I read the policy brief that you wrote, that your center wrote, and I thought I view it as a friendly amendment on my Hamilton project paper, and it just reiterates the broader point that I'm making, that whether your goal is addressing distribution or efficiency, you need revenue in order to do it, and that's where auctioning is critical.
Yes.
David Dolganoff from Middlebury College, and this fall from Dan Hugelman Strategy. My question is, how would you guys respond to the claim that a cap and trade market such as that proposed in the Lieberman water bill would cause 1.2 to 1.4 million jobs, a net loss of 1.2 to 1.4 million jobs. Just for to whomever would like to answer.
I couldn't tell you whether or not that was accurate or not, but one of the things I just think that your comment brings up, which I think is an important observation, is that none of the panelists here have focused on job losses. And I think that's in part because we don't have models that do a good job of figuring out what job losses might be. But they come about through the same mechanism that shareholder losses come about, which is that it's existing capital owners and existing workers in these industries who will be impacted. And there will be significant losses to workers in some of those sectors. How great they are, I don't know. And I can't comment on that explicitly, but I just think it's an important thing to think about that we often overlook because models don't capture that very well.
Can I just add one thing? Because this is another dichotomy that exists. The political world often focuses on job losses, and economists often focus on output or welfare effects. And I think it is important to realize that basically the mechanism through which you get analyses like that is a shift of demand away from carbon-intensive goods and services and towards other things. And economists believe that over the medium to long term, what you would do is largely shift jobs from one sector to another. So focusing on the impact on the number of jobs as opposed to output or welfare effects isn't really getting at the central issue.
Let me add one point, which is I agree with Peter about the medium and the long term, but just as we saw significant losses under auctioning of capital in the short term because capital is roughly fixed in the short term, you get these windfall losses. As Terry said, it's analogous that you get significant job losses in the short term, particularly in those industries where mobility of workers is limited, where retraining is difficult, where workers may have very specialized skills. The modeling is perfectly analogous to the modeling of capital adjustment. And I think one thing that makes auctioning look a little bit better is that some of the revenue that's enjoyed from auctioning could not only be used to compensate capital owners, but could be used to help finance retraining or transition assistance to displaced workers. So I do think it's a problem, but I think that you have to weigh that against the benefits that you're getting from the policy over time.
And just to add one more comment, the entire value added for compensation of the coal industry is on the order of $5 billion a year. So it's not that much that we're talking about. That's if we were to wipe that industry out, which we're not going to do. And moreover, if you think about what the impact is going to be, it's Western coal that's going to be particularly impacted. And there are very few workers in Western coal. That's all mechanized. Eastern coal, in fact, could be benefited to the extent that we move to IGCC combustion with carbon capture and storage. The hard eastern coal actually is preferable for that kind of combustion, and that's where the workers are. So it's more complicated. It's a very complicated issue.
Okay, we have time for just one last very quick question.
Sure. Holmes Hummel from Congressman Inslee's office. The question was, should we give away or sell cap and trade allowances? I've heard we should auction 80 to 90% of the permits. We should reserve 15% of the revenue to be dedicated for tax relief to low-income households. But what I haven't heard today is a comment on one of the main features for allocation that I've seen in proposals, which is a dial towards auctioning from initial allocation. So I've seen proposals go from 50% allocation today to 100% allocation tomorrow. I haven't heard any comment on transition or transition timing. So could I ask for a comment on that important design element?
Well, first of all, the 10 to 20% pre-allocation number, that's an average. And you could get, in my model, equivalent results if you did a larger percentage in the short term of pre-allocation and then minored it out over time. I think here is where political considerations may dominate. I think it's politically more expeditious in order to have a large share of free allocation in the short term and have that drop over time. We've certainly seen that in the European Union and also in some in various proposals. So in terms of the economics of the overall effects over the long term, it doesn't make a difference so long as on average through time it's around 10 to 20%. For political reasons, I do think that starting with a higher number and having it to come down and therefore move to 100% auctioning does make a lot of sense.
All right, I want to thank Terry for moderating and the entire panel for getting us off to a great start. Just to keep things on time, we will take a break, but we're going to shorten the break a little bit. We'll come back at 11 o'clock.